Okay, Saul's kingdom comes to an end in this manner, and what we see happening next is a very important thing, and I think a number of you have heard me present a Bible study on this particular matter, but others have not. So for those of you that have heard it, I ask your indulgence for the sake of those that have not. Also, it isn't bad to review. And this is the matter that, jumping ahead in time to the death of Solomon, we are faced with the fact that because it was God's will that the house of David be punished and that Israel as a people indeed to a degree be punished, that the kingdom be split off from each other as completely separate entities, and they then continued the rest of their national existences in that manner as separate entities. With the kingdom of Israel in the north, I think most of you know that, right? I remember Mr. Halford lecturing to his OTS class. No, actually, I'm sorry, it wasn't his class. He came into the prophecy class, the biblical prophecy class, a few years ago. And he suddenly had a thought that maybe people didn't know that. And he asked everybody to close their eyes so nobody could see whose hand went up. And he said, how many of you don't know which kingdom was the northern kingdom, Israel or Judah? And a third of the hands went up. So, you know, I shouldn't take that for granted that everybody knows the kingdom of Judah was in the south and the kingdom of Israel was in the north. But we're struck by the fact that we have a very interesting circumstance, which you can read about in 1 Kings chapter 12. Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel were come to Shechem to make him king. And we, again, when we see this phrase, all Israel, we have to be careful with it because the context must define what is meant. And it came to pass when Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who was yet in Egypt, heard of it, for he was fled from the presence of King Solomon, that they sent and called him. And Jeroboam and all the congregation of Israel came and spoke to Rehoboam, you know, and they made their complaints about Solomon and how harsh he had been, and asked him to give a sign to the people that he would be letting up on the severity, and they would be loyally, serve him loyally as his subjects. But Rehoboam, rather than take the advice of the older, wiser men, was led by the more selfish young men in threatening them even greater with greater severity. And so what was the end response? Verse 13, the king answered the people roughly and forsook the old men's counsel that they gave him. Verse 16, so when all Israel saw that the king hearkened not to them, now who is this all Israel? The people answered the king, saying, what portion have we in David? Neither have we inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel, see to your own house, David. So Israel departed to their tents. But as for the children of Israel which dwelt in the cities of Judah, Rehoboam reigned over them. And so we come down here to verse 19. So Israel rebelled against the house of David unto this day. Verse 20. It came to pass when all Israel heard that Jeroboam was come again, they sent and called him to the congregation and made him king over all Israel. Was he king over everybody? Is that what all Israel means? There was none that followed the house of David, only the tribe of Judah. You see, so all Israel doesn't mean all of them. The context clearly tells us it means all the northern tribes. Now, this is the interesting point. They come and they are about to, they're negotiating with Rehoboam the subject of whether they will continue to be satisfied to be ruled by him. And the northern tribes reject him. They reject him, they reject Jerusalem as the capital, and they decide to set up their own kingdom with their own king, with their own capital. Of course, God was the author of all this. It wasn't just their own doings. But what name did they put on their kingdom that they set up, their secessionist kingdom? Israel. So we're struck with something that's very interesting. Where else in history do we read about a group of people seceding from a nation and retaining the name of the nation? When the South seceded from the Union, did they continue to call themselves the United States of America? No, they chose a new name. When some of the tribes, especially the, get the right tribe now, in Nigeria, the predominantly Christian tribe in Nigeria, what is it called? Well, when certain of the tribes of Nigeria seceded from that country, they didn't continue to call their country Nigeria. They called it Biafra. When the people of East Pakistan seceded from the people of West Pakistan, they didn't call their country Pakistan. They called it Bangladesh. Why is it then that these northerners who walk out of the existing system, rejecting the government of that country and the capital of that country, that they continue to use the name? Well, first of all, of course, it was prophesied that that's what would happen. Jacob, in blessing Ephraim and Manasseh, said, "Let my name be named on them." And Jacob's name, of course, was Israel. That had to happen that way. That had to happen that way. But what we have to understand is that this is not something that happened overnight, and that there is a very logical reason why, when they separated, they have the name Israel, leaving the southerners to retain the name Judah. And the answer, of course, is that this is not the first time the kingdom split. This was the second time the kingdom split. The only king to rule a nation called Israel was Saul. No other king ruled a nation called Israel, implying all the tribes under one name. David did not rule a kingdom called Israel, involving all the tribes. Now let's see why that was so. I'll draw some small diagrams so that you can see this clearly. That Saul ruled a kingdom called Israel. He was king of Israel. Then we come to the time of his death in battle. What is it that happened following his death in battle? A division of the kingdom into two kingdoms. The kingdom of Judah is created in the south. The kingdom of Israel is created in the north. Now, why is the original name retained by the north? Besides the fact that, of course, God prophesied that the northern tribes would carry that name. Let's see if we can just see it in a logical way. Who became the king of this northern kingdom of Israel after the death of Saul? No? Yes. Saul's son, Ish-bosheth, becomes the king of what is still called Israel. In other words, the royal family has its authority continued here. It has the right to perpetuate the name. The tribe of Judah was not willing to continue to follow the house of Saul. They seceded from the house of Saul and asked David to be their king. And that's why, of course, they were not allowed, you see, to use the name of Israel. They had to use a different name, and they chose the name of Judah, which was their own tribal name. And so David became king of Judah, while Ish-bosheth became king of Israel. And this condition existed for a number of years. Then notice what happened. Ish-bosheth was murdered. And so we come to a situation where in the south we have the kingdom of Judah being ruled by David. In the north, we have the kingdom of Israel, and they have no king. They have no leader. They have no head. And so what did the elders of Israel do? They come down to Hebron, as we read in 2 Samuel chapter 5. Then came all the tribes of Israel, and again, this only makes sense if we view it in the context of meaning the northern tribes. The other tribes would have had no reason to come to David at this time. Then came all the tribes of Israel, meaning the northern tribes, to David, to Hebron, saying, "Behold, we are your bone and your flesh. In times past when Saul was king over us, you it was who was leading us out and bringing in Israel. The Eternal said to you, 'You shall feed my people Israel. You shall be captain over Israel.'" There's that use of the word Nagid again. "So all the elders of Israel came to the king to Hebron, and King David," notice he's king already because he's king of Judah, "made a league with them in Hebron before the Eternal, and they anointed David to be king over Israel." It would be ludicrous to suppose that the tribal leaders of Judah participated in this because he already was their anointed king. You know, it has to mean the northern tribes. But does that mean that at this time then, we then proceed with the elders of the northern tribes, meaning Israel, that northern kingdom, anointing David? That now we have one kingdom again under just one name. Well, the scripture tells us otherwise. "In Hebron he reigned over Judah for 7 years and 6 months. And in Jerusalem he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah." And so you see what the Bible is telling us, and we'll see other scriptures in a minute that tell us the same thing. My boxes have to get narrower, sorry, is that we perpetuate the kingdom of Judah in the south with its king David, and we perpetuate the kingdom of Israel in the north, which with also David as the king. In the same way, if you want a more modern, though it's not modern, a later analogy, consider what happened in 1603. Queen Elizabeth I died. At the time of her death, this was the situation. In the south, you had the Kingdom of England, and the ruler was Elizabeth. In the north, you had the Kingdom of Scotland, whose king was James VI. When she died, what happened? You had still two kingdoms. The kingdom of Scotland, with its ruler King James VI. But that same James came to London and became anointed as King of England and became known as James I of England. But the two countries did not become one kingdom. They remained two separate kingdoms. They just happened to have the same ruler. It was not until 1714 that an act of Parliament did away with the Scottish Parliament and united the two kingdoms in one. And even then it was a less than perfect union. Because what is the national or established church of England? The Church of England, the Anglican Church. But what is the established church in Scotland? It's a completely different church. You see, they maintain a difference. And if you travel in Scotland, you even notice that you will find, of course, British pound notes, the typical English pound notes, but you also find Scottish pound notes. And now, of course, because of devolution, the Scottish Parliament has acquired some revival to a degree. So exactly the same thing happened in the case of England and Scotland. They, you know, at least for this period of 111 years, were perpetuated as two separate kingdoms sharing a common ruler. Another example in Europe would be the case in the 19th century of the country that was known after the 1848 revolution as Austria-Hungary. They were two separate countries with two separate nobilities, two separate parliaments. They shared a common ruler who was known as Emperor of Austria and King of Hungary, the same person. This is the situation that we see here in the instance with David. There are several places where we can see where this was done, that we can see this double nature of his kingdom being made evident. One of these places, of course, I'm not doing them in chronological order, I'm just going at them in the ones that are probably best known, is in chapter 24 of 2 Samuel, when David made a bad error of judgment, committed a bad error of judgment, and decided to number the fighting men of Israel, something that he was never supposed to do. How was that census carried out? He gives his command. Notice it says in verse 1 that David said, go number Israel. No, he says, go number Israel and Judah. The king said to Joab, the captain of the host, go through all the tribes of Israel from Dan to Beersheba, in other words, throughout the entire length of my administration, that I may know the number of the people. And when he comes back, how does he report the number? In verse 9, Joab gave up the sum of the number of the people to the king. There were in Israel 800,000 valiant men that drew the sword, and the men of Judah were 500,000. So even the reckoning was done by separate kingdoms. Another instance of this double nature is shown in 2 Samuel. It's after the revolt of Absalom, so that would have to be in chapter 19. This is after Absalom's rebellion has collapsed. Joab has killed Absalom. David had asked that nobody harm him. He'd be taken alive, but Joab saw that it was more prudent to kill him. It was told Joab that, behold, the king weeps and mourns for Absalom. And of course, Joab told the king this was a very bad thing to be publicly doing. The people who had risked everything to be his loyal followers instead of deserting to Absalom and had struggled so hard to keep him as king wouldn't very well appreciate, you know, this kind of an attitude on his behalf. And David saw the sense of that and changed his attitude. But notice what it says here in verse 9. All the people were at strife throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, the king of saved us out of the hand of our enemies. He delivered us out of the hand of the Philistines, and he has fled out of the land for Absalom. And now Absalom, whom we anointed over us, is dead in battle. Why don't we speak a word about bringing the king back? Meaning, you know, bringing David back and showing that we return to his rule. We are willing to have him be our king again. So let's continue reading down here in verse 11. King David sent to Zadok and Abiathar the priests, saying, speak to the elders of Judah, saying, why are you the last to bring the king back to his house, seeing that the speech of all Israel has come to the king, even to his house? You see what the problem was? Absalom had taken both kingdoms away from David. Now both, it was first the northerners, described here as all Israel, who said, look, you know, what, we've made a bad mistake. We transferred our loyalty from David to Absalom. Absalom is dead. We know that David is a man favored by God, and he's also the one who saved us from our mortal enemies, the Philistines. Let's let him know that we're willing to have him come back and be our king, and we're willing to be his loyal subjects. And David is very upset. He says, why is it I have to hear from those northerners that I'm not even related to by blood before I hear from my own tribe, Judah, that they're willing to have me come back as their king also? He says, this is really very upsetting. So send a message to those elders of Judah and say, how come you're the last that I hear from? Since I've already heard from the northerners that they will take me back. After all, you are my bones and my flesh. Notice it says in verse 14 that he bowed the heart of all the men of Judah, even as the heart of one man. So they sent this word to the king, return and all your servants. So David then is now able to get both of his kingdoms back. But notice what happens. The king returns and comes to the Jordan. And Judah came to Gilgal to go to meet the king, to conduct the king over the Jordan. Shimei, the son of Gera, a Benjaminite, which was the Bahurim, hasted out and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. And there were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him, and Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, and gives all these people. And Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king as he came over the Jordan, and said to the king, let not my lord impute iniquity to me, and don't remember what your servant did perversely the day that you went out from Jerusalem. We don't have to worry about what incident that was. If you know, that's fine. If not, don't worry about it. But the important point is in verse 20. Your servant does know that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I am come the first this day of the house of Joseph to go down to meet my lord the king. In other words, of all the northerners, I am right there first, knowing that I have wronged you more than anyone, to show you that I am sorry and that I am willing to accept you again as my king. Notice what happens after this very interesting event concerning the people that have come to bring the king over back into his kingdom. Notice it really picks up after this matter of Mephibosheth. We'll skip over that for now. Verse 39. All the people went over the Jordan. Verse 40. The king went on to Gilgal, and Kimham went on with him, and all the people of Judah conducted the king, and also half the people of Israel. So he sort of had a sort of an honor guard, you know, bringing him back with great pomp and ceremony. And the main precedence was given to the house of Judah, and the Israelites, the northern kingdom, was given sort of a secondary position in the honor of bringing the king back. Behold, all the men of Israel came to the king, and they said to him, why have our brethren, the men of Judah, stolen you away, and have brought the king and his household, and David's, meaning all of David's men, with him over the Jordan? All the men of Judah answered the men of Israel. They can't, because, don't get so upset about this. Why are you making a mountain out of a molehill? The fact that there are more of us here conducting the king than you. After all, the king is near of kin to us. So don't get upset about a trifling little thing. After all, have we eaten at all at the king's cost? Has he been feeding us at his expense? And has he made some special gift to us that gives us visible preeminence above you? I mean, there's no reason to get upset about this business. But the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, look, we've got 10 parts in the king, so we have more right to David than you. Why is it then you despise us that our advice should not have been first in bringing back the king? And the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel. You see, you've got two clearly separate units, each one with their own very unique sense of identity. They don't see themselves as one any longer. They see themselves as existing in these two units, each with their own individual identity. And there's a great deal of competition and jealousy. How do we know that this was a period of strife between these two kingdoms? How do we know that this was a period where they were frequently at odds with each other? Because this is all we see, really, in the text. But what does it establish, that this cannot be just an isolated incident? What can we see in this? But in addition, even after David becomes their joint king, how can we tell the tension did not die, but there continued to be tension and rivalry and jockeying for position under David? How does this incident illustrate that that must have been the case? Think about it. Was it really a small thing? Why are they so upset about it? Do people who basically are in good terms with their fellows get so violently upset about a small incident like this? No, only when there's been continuing sources of friction, you see, even little things tend to irritate more than would seem to be necessary. We've got this friction. And as I say, it clearly reveals, even in the text, the way it's printed itself, that there's a sense of separateness between these two groups of people. They each have their own sense of unique identity. Notice that when this tension began to really boil over in chapter 20, there happened to be a man of Belial whose name was Sheba, who was a Benjaminite. He blew a trumpet and said, "We have no part in David. Neither have we inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel." Who is he talking to when he says, "O Israel"? And we have no inheritance in David and no inheritance in the son of Jesse. So, yeah. Because they're the ones that are disgusted with their seeming lack of favorable treatment. "So every man of Israel went up from after David and followed Sheba the son of Bichri, but the men of Judah clave to their king." It looked like the kingdom now was going to split under two different dynasties at this point in time. Now, the rebellion collapsed. But you see, if you look at this wording here, interestingly, that Sheba raised, notice what he says. "We have no part in David. We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tent of Israel." Go back and look in 2 Kings 12 at what Jeroboam uses as his rallying cry. It's almost the same terminology. It's like an old cry, you know, reused. An old admonition, you see, being reused again. An old slogan, if you will, being reused again. Showing that from the time of this period under David until the time when the kingdom split again under Rehoboam, things did not really die down. And I think if you look through the scriptures again, you will see that Solomon's kingdom was also a dual kingdom. Not only is that revealed in 1 Kings chapter 4 in the way he set up the administration of the kingdom, but it's also revealed that he also has a double coronation, showing him to be king over both as separate units. And so what you have are these two separate units from the time of the death of Saul that after David is accepted as their king, they coexist but in a very uneasy relationship. It's not the case of a peaceful, unified kingdom being split violently at the end of Solomon's reign. It's these two kingdoms being held together because God was blessing the family of David. And it's the case that at that point, after Solomon dies, God says, "Okay, I just take my hands off. I'm not going to keep these two units that are quarrelsome and antagonistic to each other. I'm not going to keep working to keep them together. I take my hands off, and I appoint somebody, and then Jeroboam, to be the leader, and we'll let natural tendencies take their course, and they're going to separate. And I will appoint Jeroboam to be their king." And so we have to appreciate this aspect of the internal affairs of the kingdom of David. It's something he never was able to successfully overcome. He was never able to bring these people back together again, to make them of one spirit, of one mind, to really develop the kind of unity that God's people needed to have. And Solomon did not achieve it either. And so this lies behind the walkout. And it helps to explain that for all these years, that northern set of tribes had this as their identity. So when they walk out, what is more natural than that they should preserve what is their name and has been their name ever since the death of Saul? It is the name that they are entitled to. It explains why they retained it. Okay, let you go.